the Rockhurst Regent currently. So my interest in education is in lifelong learning has continued to increase as I unfortunately age. I would like for you to start out by introducing yourselves and the organization you represent, and please, no commercials, just who you are and who you represent. So who wants to be the brave soul to stand up and model this? Okay, you're on.
Hi, I'm Tom Dart. I'm with Rockhurst University.
Oh, great, perfect.
I'm Jennifer McKnight, and I'm also a Rockhurst.
Okay.
I'm Elaine Needham, and I'm with the Urban Research Foundation.
I'm Carl Watson with Career Point Center.
And I'm Mary Ellen Clark with Jeffrey Byrne and Associates.
I'm Lori Nelson with the Community Foundation.
Jennifer Furlow with Jeffrey Byrne and Associates.
Okay, so I'd like to hear from a few of you why you came today. I mean, it's a lovely day out. It's rainy. It's cold. It's miserable. But what brought you here? I don't want to know the name of your car. I just want to know. Why did you come?
The Urban Research Foundation is brand new. I need to get back into networking. I quit 20 years ago to go back to school. Don't know anybody, need to make new connections. Learn what's new, okay. Get back on board.
Right. Did you hear her?
Yes.
Okay, great. Anybody else? Don't be shy.
Right. No, as Carl Roscoe, Career Point Center is a new organization, hopefully soon to be a 501c3. We are helping the seasoned professional to redo and get into the job market. I came not only to network, but to learn more.
And I want to ask what the seasoned professional is, but I'm afraid to. I think I am, too. Anybody else want to share why you came today?
Didn't mean to imply that I was a seasoned professional.
Anybody else?
Okay, thanks, Dan. As I said, this is the Elder Hostel Lifelong Learning Institute in Kansas City, and our programs are for persons 55 and older, and so that's a difficult group we have found to find funding for, and so any networking we can do, we are trying to do.
Great. Thank you all for sharing that. Before we begin, I want to share an amazing technological advance in fundraising with you, and it's called the TRAP process. Does that sound good? So what I want you to do is to turn off your cell phone or put it on mute. And if it happens to go off, then you will be invited to write a check for $100 to the charity of your choice, which I'm sure is going to be your organization. But Jeffrey Byrne and Associates, although we're not a charity, we are always grateful for gifts from our friends and clients. This started out as a joke. Very good. Good, Elaine. I thought I had you as a joke several years ago. And one meeting, I walked out and gave the organization $600 in $100 checks and another one $400 in $400 checks. So I said, you know, this is a good deal. And it's, you know, you don't have to invest in a lot of money. You just have to warn them up front what's going to happen. So now that everybody's cell phone is turned off, we will go ahead and begin. I want to share a story with you. Last summer, I had the privilege to be in Colorado a lot of the time. I think part of my soul is in the mountains there. And I attended an event sponsored by the Salvation Army. And this was a fundraising event called the Empty Soup Bowl. And it was started by a group of volunteers with the organization. They weren't, you know, it wasn't a big elaborate deal. In a two-month time, they planned it. They got artists to donate the soup bowls. They got restaurants in the Vail Valley to contribute. And their goal was to get 200 people there. Well, people kept coming and coming and coming. And by the time they ran out of soup, they had raised over $9,000 with minimum involvement. In sharing this story yesterday, I learned that the students at Shawnee Mission East High School have been doing the same thing. They get kids in the ceramics department at the high school to make the bowls, Panera bread donates the soup, and these kids raise money for people, home, you know, soup kitchens, things like that. So I think it's the stories of one, which excites me, is the youth involved and taking on a project because they have so much enthusiasm and they're learning about the needs of people in their community. And it's quick, efficient, and successful. So I just wanted to share that particular story with you. Now, part of our corporate value is partnership at Jeffrey Burnham Associates. So we really want to partner with you in making this a successful workshop. We have lots of good information, but we want you to interact with us, share, ask questions, share stories, so that we all can learn. And I think if you do ask a question, it would be nice if you tell us who you are so people can begin to learn the names in the room. And with that, I am going to turn this over to Jennifer Furla.
Get all of Barbara's props.
Yeah. Make sure everybody's done this, please. It's really helpful to us to see who you are.
Oops. Bear with me here. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Jennifer Furla, and beyond my work at Jeffrey Byrne & Associates, I have the pleasure of serving as a director of the Giving USA Foundation. Just by a quick show of hands, how many of you were here with us in July to hear Dr. Rooney give the overall? Okay, good. Some, but not all. So my job this morning is not to go back over that information. It is available to you through the Jeffrey Byrne & Associates website, but to reflect back a little bit on Giving USA and then bring it home. You know, the Giving in Kansas City report was a function, a product of many years of discussion and much work on the part of the Community Foundation in partnering with us to help raise substantial funds to undergo this research. Really the first time, while we've had other reports on giving in Kansas City, the first time that we've had the resources and the credibility of the Center on Philanthropy to do that. So hope that you saw the coverage on that back in July in the Kansas City Star. And if you'll remember that headline that day, it was Kansas Citians are among the most generous. And when it comes to giving in Kansas City, we give more than the national average. And we give where our hearts are, which generally is to human needs. Now, that is not bad news for those of us who are sitting here today in education. I'm going to go over some of the information for you that's excerpted on in the education sector, and we'll talk about some of those implications. So what's the big picture? Giving in the United States last year was $307 billion. If you are a number follower, you might remember that the year before, we also announced that giving in the United States for the previous year, for 07, was $307 billion. Well, the headlines, though, were that giving was actually down. What happens is that when we do these giving reports, this is so that you could explain this to your donors, board members, et cetera, when we do these giving reports and announce the data in July, it's an estimate. by the end of the year, it is usually revised upward. So real giving in 2007 was $314 billion, the highest ever. And when it came to this summer announcing where we were for 08, it was back down to $307 billion, the final numbers. And so it represented a decrease. Now, what you see here is a pie chart that indicates how that was divvied up. And one of our big lessons for Giving USA, for those of you who are maybe just starting out on this journey in terms of fundraising, Elaine, Carl, Jan, et cetera, is that the majority, vast majority of giving is given by whom? What?
Individuals.
Right? You can see it right up there. Less than 18% nationally is given by corporations and foundations. And that includes the Gates Foundations, the AT&Ts, the Ford Foundations, the Carnegies, the Hall Family Foundations here. Now, in Kansas City, corporations and foundations are a little bit more generous. We don't have a slide in your book, but I'd like to give you the big numbers for Kansas City, so write these down. That $307 billion, anybody want to venture a guess what Kansas City represents of that? How much total giving in Kansas City was? Jeffrey can't call on Jeffrey. Somebody beyond Jeffrey Byrne. Dollars. Give me some dollars because I'm not that good at math.
About 60 to 70 billion.
60 to 70 billion? Well, actually, it's... Did you say million or billion? Okay. It's 2.15 billion. That represents about... is it 0.8%? Lori, I'm looking for a confirmation, which is just about what Kansas City's population is represented to the whole of the United States. So that's not bad. To me, that's a phenomenal number that Kansas Cityans give over $2 billion to charity each year, given where we are in terms of the market. Let's look at what that represents in terms of these pieces of the pie. You can write these numbers out right to the side here. Foundations in Kansas City gave $393 million. That's significant when you understand that across the board, all the sources, about 65 to 70% of those dollars stay right here in Kansas City. Corporations gave $150 million. And that big piece of the pie to all organizations in Kansas City and out of Kansas City for individuals, households, is about $1.6 billion. That's a lot of money. Okay? So let's look at where that goes. Now we're back to Giving USA. And just want to point out that in terms of the pieces of the pie, it probably won't surprise you that overall faith, religion and faith-based organizations receive the largest percent of giving nationally. But look at where education falls, number two. That represents all giving, individuals, foundations, corporations nationally, and represents about, what, $40 billion nationally. I do want to make a couple of footnotes on this slide for you to show you how it moves. Back when I started in fundraising some years ago, religion made traditionally about what? What do you think? What percentage of the pie? 50%, exactly. Since then, religion has continued to grow, but the pie has grown. And if Melissa Brown, who's the chief researcher for this report, were here, she would talk to you about the fact that there have been new sectors coming up. Look at international affairs, environment, and animals. Those are smaller percentages of the pie, and they're relatively new. Gifts to foundations is a new trend since the changes in the tax code in the mid-'80s. This year, for the first time, grants to individuals was significant enough that it became a piece of the pie. So giving to religion, giving to education has continued to grow in terms of real dollars, but the pie has gotten so much bigger. Okay? So I just wanted to point that out to you so it's fluid. It's not always a static snapshot. Okay, so let's look at the sources of contributions Kansas City compared to the United States. As I mentioned, that individuals are represented here as households represent about $1.6 billion. You can see that in Kansas City, households made up a little smaller share of the pie. When you add household giving and bequest giving, all giving by individuals living and dead, you've got about 75%. You can see that corporations and foundations in Kansas City are much more meaningful to overall giving to the nonprofit sector. They're outpacing 25% to about 18% when you combine those two sources together. What does that mean for this whole bar chart for giving to education? Giving Kansas City said that in the year measured, overall, all sources, $275 million went to education. Now, who is part of that sector? That's higher education. We've got Rockhurst. We have Avila. We have UMKC here. Maybe KU Endowment. That is charter schools. That is alternative schools like De La Salle, private schools like Notre Dame de Sion, and then educationally affiliated organizations. So it's all across the board. And when we get to corporate giving, I want to highlight just a couple of dynamics that are reflected in the average gift size that represent how that giving is put together. So in terms of who's getting those dollars, look at where education falls in terms of recipients of the charitable dollars. You can see that compared to national, it's getting about the same percentage of the pie, 13% in Kansas City versus 14% nationally. That's not statistically significant difference. Where religion, for instance, as you can see, is much higher. Giving in Kansas City to religious and faith-based organizations significantly outpaces the national average. But you can see that education giving is pretty much up within the top levels and likewise is among the highest sectors in terms of receiving charitable gifts. This is what's called a histogram, and it tells you where the sources of giving are by sector. So what you have running down the far left side are the various sectors, and then if you follow those bars across, you have what represents households, foundations, bequest giving, and corporate giving. So let's look at environment and animals across the top just to give you an example. You can see here that roughly almost a quarter of the giving for that sector comes evenly spread among all those sources. Look down at education. In the education sector, that giving is also fairly evenly spread. 28% of giving to education coming from households, 38% coming from foundations, 11% from bequests, and 22% from corporations. So 80% of what you all are getting is coming from individuals and foundations. How does that measure up to what your pie looks like in terms of your how you distribute, receive your charitable giving? All right, so if a 38% is coming from the foundations, that represents, as I indicated, about $393 million. With 60% of that staying in Kansas City. Melissa Brown did a session with the Thunders here a couple of weeks ago as part of this, and she talked about average trends for foundation giving nationally. Across all foundations to all sources, the average grant nationally is $30,000. So when you take that information and lay that against this chart, which shows average grant size in Kansas City to education at $31,000 and median grant size in Kansas City to education at $2,000, you can see that you're doing a little bit better than the national average in terms of foundation giving. There are a couple of pieces of information that are in the report that aren't shown by graphs that I want to point out to you, though. 75% of all foundation giving is represented by the top 10 foundations in Kansas City. And there's a list of those in the report available on all of our websites. OK, Okay, that's a, to me, that's a big number. We all know they're usual suspects in Kansas City. With forgive me for the funders in the room who might be aware of that comment, but I don't think that that it's really quite as I didn't realize it was really quite as acute as that. So 75% of foundation funding, those dollars, coming from the top 10 foundations, and 47% of the dollars represented in the year measured from two sources, the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation, representing 32% of all giving, and Hall Family Foundation, representing just under 16% of all giving. Kind of interesting. A couple of other interesting pieces of data to note, that of the top 10 grants that were made in the year measured, three went to higher education. The very top grant went to Harvard University, a donor-advised grant coming from the Community Foundation, and grants numbers 9 and number 10 in terms of the size of the dollars going to KU Endowment. Now, we know that KU Endowment and the University of Missouri system were undergoing a major campaign at that time, so it's probably not surprising, but it does reflect where the emphasis is in terms of what's driving foundation giving. Another point that is worth pointing out, particularly for those of you who are not in higher education, when you're looking at grant sizes here, the $31,000 is very enticing. But look at the median grant. Median, if you remember back to statistics, is the midpoint, meaning half the grants are higher than $2,000, half the grants are lower than $2,000. $2,000, what's the return on investment in terms of the time spent in a heavy, heavy emphasis on foundation grants? Let's look quickly at corporate foundation. Corporate foundation represent, or corporate giving overall represents $150 million in Kansas City. 66% of those dollars stay here. $20 million of that, or 13%, comes from corporate foundation. So corporate giving includes cash, in-kind, cause marketing, and corporate foundation gifts. Now, where the average foundation gift is $31,000, the average corporate foundation gift is to education is $1,500. What's driving that down, do you think? Anybody want to guess?
The number of requests.
Number of requests. Actually, that's a really good point. In terms of corporate giving, education represents 30% of the dollars and 25% of the whole pie in terms of grants. So there are a lot. There's a high volume of smaller grants, scholarships, employee matching funds, smaller gifts to elementary and secondary education foundations, that type of thing. I made a note to check on this. I also wonder if there is possibly some grant making to early childhood education centers in there that would be driving that down. Okay. So if $1.6 billion is given by Kansas City area households, individuals, then it probably makes sense to take a look at that. Let's look at where that giving goes in terms of the priorities of giving. Again, 58% to religion. That doesn't surprise you because religion is very much driven by household giving. 12% and 14%, are you all having a hard time reading this as I am? 12% and 11% combined going to human needs. And then education stands right in that next tier along with health. So that is probably not surprising. I would think for those of you who are working in education, the challenge would be, how do we increase that share of the pie? If we have opportunities to focus on individual giving, how do we increase our market share, and what are we doing with respect to that? Of the household giving to education, it was interesting for me to note in the report that 18% went to math and science. So 82% to other, but where is that emphasis coming from? That would not surprise me in terms of corporate giving, in terms of foundation giving, but in terms of individual household giving. So that's something that you might want to think about. Another piece of information that I thought was very enlightening is that of the household giving, when it comes to bequest giving, and this is not in the slides, education was the number one sector in receiving bequests. 37% of bequest giving went to education and educational institutions. Okay, so what are some other quick ahas about the Giving in Kansas City report when it comes to individual giving? Clearly, Kansas Cityans are more generous than the rest of the country. This was the headline in the paper. Over nearly half again more is given to charity in terms of an average total contribution by Kansas City households compared to those in the United States. That's great news. It's also pretty interesting to look at how those dollars are spread in terms of average gift when you start looking at higher net worth donors. So what you have here is a slide that shows households of lower incomes, $50,000 or less in combined household income, households in the mid-range of $50,000 to $100,000 in combined household income, and then households of $100,000 or more. And look at that number. The higher the income level, clearly the more generous the donor is. When you add that to education levels, where you have a similar spread, highly educated donors with a college education are where it's at for overall giving. So who are your donors? I mean, to me, that was great news for the education sector because that's exactly who your target audience is. Now, there is a slide in here about age range, and I think this is instructive, too. We work with a couple of independent primary schools, private schools, and they are continually challenged by the approach to major gifts and getting responses back from these families. Well, we're already paying hefty tuitions. Or we are spending time with giving back to the school through special events and through other fundraising activities. So that is clearly a dynamic and a challenge, and maybe when we get to discussion, some of you all can address either that same challenge or some creative ways that you've gone about addressing that. But when we're talking about institutions where there's an alumni base, I guess it was surprising to me to see that the giving levels were so much higher in the 40 to 64 range, meaning your years when you're accumulating wealth, and then dropping off toward the end. Now, one reason for this is measuring lifetime giving. This isn't necessarily measuring bequest giving. So if you added bequest giving in here, that 65-plus age range would go way up. But this certainly gives us some reason to be optimistic about focusing on the boomers right now and even focusing on those who are 45 and younger. So Kansas Cityans are more generous all the way across the board, and you want to be focusing your efforts in that boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, and millennial range. Now, education makes up a very important part of our livelihood within our greater Kansas City community. And I'm going to ask Lori Larson to come up and talk about that a little bit and education's impact overall.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good morning. We are going to shift gears just a little bit here. We've been focusing on the results from the Giving in Kansas City report, which focuses just on charitable giving. So we're talking about individuals, households, foundations, corporations, and bequests. What we're going to be looking at in these next few slides is the economic impact of the nonprofit sector in Kansas City and really focusing in on the education sector. So what this slide is showing you is a snapshot of the overall look of our nonprofit sector. You'll see that the health, public benefit, and human services really dominate as far as total revenue generation. We've got two different bars here. The light blue is the total percent of organizations in the sector, and then the darker blue is the total percent of revenue that's generated. And I've highlighted education in the green. But what this shows us is these top three sectors are generating about 80% of the revenue. Education comes in at about 10%. What is very significant about this also is that as we look across the sectors, for education specifically, if we look at charitable giving, you all are consistently in the top four. And then if we roll the additional sources of what we're looking at here, not only charitable giving, but we're looking at government grants and we're looking at earned revenue. So this is why the pictures look a little bit different and the dynamics work a little bit differently. But education is very consistent and clearly at the top as far as Kansas City's economic impact and its importance to sustaining quality of life as well. This next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about and drill down really into these sectors themselves. Again, we've got some sectors that are really dominating the education sector. These first three are generating, the first three are generating 87%, but that's only 41% of the organization. So we have some kind of unusual things going on here that we're going to talk a little bit more about. The first bar that you see on the left is generating 60% of the revenue and only 3% of the organizations. So as we go to the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit more about this. One of the things that is important to see in this slide is that you're seeing these top three sectors are clearly generating significantly more revenue than they have organizations in the marketplace. And it would be very easy to jump to the conclusion that these types of organizations are more successful than the ones that have more organizations in the marketplace versus having revenue generation. And if we do that, we are excluding something that's very important about the work that you do, and that's your programs. So one of the things I want to talk about is making sure that you have really got some great stories and anecdotes and that you don't exclude the importance of the work that you do and the outcomes that you have through your programs. It's a very important piece of your own donor education and your fundraising strategy. And making sure that you have some really simple message points that you can share with your staff, your board, and your volunteers so that they can help spread the good work that you do as well. So always make sure that you include program outcomes as part of the big picture. We all need to do this when we're thinking about the success of nonprofits. Okay, this next slide is going to show us a little bit different picture. We just talked about the fact that we have several sectors that are high revenue generation and very few orgs. And what this slide shows us is that we have got a very high number of organizations that are operating on $250,000 or less in annual revenue. This is a division by range of what percent are sorted by organization size. We have 73% of the organizations in education are operating on $250,000 or less. What's significant about this is it really is a great visual on how the smaller organizations in this sector are really helping to support the education sector as a whole. So this is a very important piece. One of the things that we know about smaller organizations is the very important piece of volunteerism. And there's been a lot of really good research done about volunteerism and the benefits that it can bring to these smaller organizations. One thing that we know is that the vitality of your volunteers is directly related to the vitality of your organization. Two things you can do to help support that is make sure you recognize and affirm the good work that your volunteers do and make sure that they have the training that they need because we are faced with changing client needs all the time. And we want to make sure that our volunteers are competent and feel confident in helping clients move through the process and can work with them. The other piece that we know about volunteers is that if people are volunteering in your organization, they are going to be more likely to give financially. We know that not all volunteers have that capacity, but one thing you can do, if they don't really understand that maybe they only have $5 or $10 to give, if you can create some visuals for them, well, if you have $5 or $10 to give, and there's 9 or 10 other volunteers who can come together with you, and they put in $5 or $10, what kind of change can you create? Can that buy 5 elementary students school supplies for the year? Can it buy 3 quality used college books? Can it buy a math tutor for 2 weeks? Because we know that people are motivated to give. They want to achieve a change, and they're also interested in a cause. And so if you can create some visuals to really make things more tangible, they know that that $5 or $10 that they have will make a change, and it is important. The other piece about volunteerism is looking in your communities for for-profit partners. We have really experienced a big cultural change as far as social responsibility and the business world. And I'm not necessarily speaking on the grounds of big corporations. Some of the smaller proprietorships that are in your geographic area are also really great targets to work with, too. When you bring, you can use this opportunity as team, or the employer can use it as team-building opportunities, bringing those individuals into your organization. You get them involved, and the cycle starts. We know that if they become interested in your organization, they are more likely to financially give, and then hopefully eventually become part of your consistent family of giving. So don't neglect the for-profit on the volunteer side as well. The social responsibility of businesses is really a win-win all the way around. The businesses win. They get great marketing exposure. Your organization wins because it helps build up your volunteer staff, and the employees are satisfied. Benefits now, not only do employees want health and retirement options, but they want to know what the business is doing to give back to their community. So it's just a great win all the way around. I want to bring to your attention that the binded slide in your book is wrong. There was a label that didn't get moved. This one is correct, and the corrected slide, which was completely my fault, is slid in the back. It was a mistake that was discovered too late to get bound, so I apologize for that. This slide takes a look at if organizations are able to really achieve a break-even point. Are your expenses being paid by the revenue that you're generating? And so what we have here is we've got 81% of organizations that are able to meet their expenses. We've got a lower percent, significantly lower, at 8% that's borderline and so on. So this slide really asks the question is, for the organizations that are borderline or are not meeting their expenses, are endowments coming into play here? What's the capacity? What's the availability? All those types of questions. Also thinking about temporary and restricted assets. Are organizations, falling back on previous year's surplus? How are we going to continue to sustain operations when we're not at a break-even point? So based on that, it's probably a good time to talk a little bit about how we can minimize expenses, continue to support our programs, increase the demand that we have in our programs, et cetera, all while hoping also to sustain our funding system, which is a piece of cake, right? Not exactly. That is the challenge. So all of that wrapped in together, many of you said that you were very interested here just to come and learn and to network. And this is really what the takeaway from this slide is, what changes can we make that can help us achieve what seems really to be almost the impossible? How can we do all this and still minimize expenses? It takes everything from casual networking, attending the Nonprofit Connect learning circles, collaborations, program sharing, program resources. Don't exclude the business or the for-profit sector either on trying to absorb some of your resources that you need, maybe for administration and that type of thing, and then all the way to collaborations. But it's a great way also for your funders to see the changes that you're willing to make. There's a lot of options before you even think about acquisitions. And all these casual and less formal types of arrangements can really help you minimize expenses and learn from each other. Maybe you're struggling with a particular program. You know of another nonprofit that is doing really well. What can you learn from them to help your program become more successful? this slide really shows the human capital investment that we have in Kansas City as far as education. You can see here that it's 58% of the private employment. It is the strongest force that we have. So don't neglect that some of your employees should be considered as your donors as well. This is a slide that looks at the primary sources of giving. And what we're looking at here is special events, foundations, corporations, individuals, government grants, and earned revenue. What's interesting about this, and this is typically the trend that we see, this is sorted or filtered by full-time employee equivalents. So based on how many employees your organization has, how do the primary revenue sources change as the organization gets bigger? If you start on the left side, and you move to the right. And there's clearly an inverse or opposite relationship between the sources. You'll note that on the far left, looking at the first couple of bars, the smaller employers are getting most of their support from charitable contributions. When you move to the right towards the larger, it changes and it goes more to earned revenue. One thing in particular that's really interesting about the education sector, we don't hardly ever see earned revenue showing up on the left-hand side of any of the other sectors. So that is a great congratulations to you all. It's very hard to achieve that, and it's already showing up here. The other thing I want to caution you on is those first two left bars have a very large piece of that, foundations and corporations. This information that we're talking about is coming from 990s, and it is extremely difficult to collect or separate individual giving from foundations and corporations. So when you see the blue and the yellow, think of those packaged together as charitable contributions, and then it makes sense. Was there a question?
Uh-huh.
Yes, it is. And this is the last slide before I turn it back over to Mary Ellen. We wanted to look a little bit deeper as far as really specific sources, where those primary revenue sources are coming from. We don't really see any consistent or redundant funding of specific funders, but what we do see is sources that very highly correlate to the graph that we just saw. The larger employers, they're getting a lot of state and federal agency money. Tuition, that's the earned revenue. Private corporate foundations. The medium-sized employers, it's really a mix. They're getting a little bit from everybody. And then the smaller employers, as we saw, the farthest left two bars is all about charitable giving the most. Okay, with that, I would like to turn it over to Judy. Mary Ellen, I'm sorry.
Good morning, everyone. In case there was any question in anyone's mind from Barbara's comment about who the student in the room was, me. And Dr. Newman's wife, who is now Professor Emeritus at Avila University, is the reason why I have a passion for these numbers and why I chose sociology as my minor. So, a great influence, obviously, we all know that educators can have on us and can have on our career paths and long-term career paths. So what we're going to visit about is the information that was gleaned from the surveys that you took on the Nonprofit Connect website. And thank you to everyone who took the time to complete those surveys. I'm not going to read all this information to you, but those of you and others in the community who completed these, we know that the vast majority or certainly over half of you have budget sizes of under $1 million and a small portion with budget sizes of over $20 million. Particularly significant comment, though, about endowment. Education is differs significantly from other large, as we saw earlier, donors to healthcare, in that only 50% of all healthcare organizations in Kansas City even have endowments, whereas 71% of those education organizations that completed our survey indicated that they had endowment. We thought it was rather impressive that only 50% of those of you who have endowments saw a drop in your endowment since January 1st. So we think that that speaks very positively, and those of you who carefully watch your investments and the market reports are breathing a little easier. We're seeing a slight turn. We may not be hearing that yet from our donors, but we have some comments later about the importance of patience in working with our donors and, importantly, listening to what they say listening carefully as we approach them. We don't hear quite so much angst from them as we are approaching them, but there is still, among certain subsectors, still some caution as they donate. Some of the changes that you reported in fundraising, only 38% have said that since January 1st that they've seen less donors in their fundraising efforts. We're excited that only 36% saw no increase from past donors. Obviously, looking at those that have seen an increase in their past donors, and we're going to get into those areas where they did see an increase from those past donors. Consistently, online giving is something that those of you who completed our survey indicated that they're turning to. Consistently in all subsectors, organizations are doing less direct mail, and they are doing more online giving. And I think that's particularly important as we look at education. Those of you who have alumni, and particularly young alumni, and my husband and I are blessed to have four young alumni who have been out of Rockers since 2001. And our youngest out of the University of Kansas. So we've got big university and small university. And, of course, I went to my closest source as I was asking, how do these statistics match up with you? And they say, online, talk to me electronically. That's what I want to hear. And that's what those young alumni are responding with. And we see that in the responses that we got from all of you. So as we look at individual giving, we saw that there was a 36% in unrestricted giving from individuals. That's certainly consistent with the statistics that were presented earlier as to where is the majority of our giving coming from. It's coming from households. When we look at foundation support, There was a small percentage that didn't see a change in their foundation support, but we know from our conversations with funders, and Jennifer referred earlier to the small, very small number of funders that make up a significant percentage of the foundation giving that you all are receiving. We know that those funders in conversations with us have said that their applications have significantly increased. We know in some of the comments that you left us in taking the survey that that's one of your strategies. That's what you've done, one of the approaches you've changed since January 1st or perhaps before. Our survey indicated since January 1st, and so that's why I'm quoting that. But you have increased the number of applications to foundations, grants, and significantly as well in certain groups, in certain subsectors, and education is no different, increased your planned giving efforts. So that is one of the clear advantages that you in education have. When we look at all nonprofit sectors, all nonprofit organizations, we look at what's the edge that you in education have? What is it? What is it that you have over polycystic kidney disease or over the Heart Association? You impact everyone. You have alumni, absolutely. When you match that up to the statistics that we saw earlier of individual giving, and particularly when you look at the significance of individual giving over $100,000 households, there is a significant opportunity that you have. It is not just for the universities. It is also for elementary schools. It's also for high schools, as long as you stay close to them. We're going to talk in just a few minutes about the responses and what we're seeing in terms of when should you be staying close to them, when should you be commenting or communicating with them. And when we look at events, this is an area that since January 1st, we have seen a change. It's consistent with the budgetary changes and the operational changes that you reported as well. You've continued to do events in education, but we've changed those events. We've been sensitive to the economy and sensitive to the responses we get from donors. Gosh, I can't believe you're still doing, you know, such a big splash. They expect cutback. They know that they have a little less to give to you, but they still want to attend your event, and they still want to support you in some way. So they are expecting a change, and you have responded, because across the board we see that event budgets have decreased. So we as organizationally have changed what we're doing, but we continue to do events. And we see an increase in corporate giving. And that's certainly consistent with what we saw. 11% in education, you report that only 11% of your giving comes from corporation. But yet in the area of events, we see that 36% of you have seen an increase in corporate giving as it relates to special events. And nearly a third of you have said you didn't see any change whatsoever in attendance at your events. And these are very significant points when we start talking about what we do with the niche you have, which is those alumni, and how you relate to them. And you can see from the slide, the increase, the net increase and decrease have balanced each other out. So these are simply some organizational changes. When we look at salaries at previous year's levels, and I encourage you before you, as you look at this, these statistics, and I'm not going to read to you these numbers, but I think it's important for us, if you're not doing valuable benchmarking, that you do that. If you look at the, refer back to the bottom of the slide on the bottom of page 9 that Lori presented to us about the benchmarking and the total, the ratios in our income to our fundraising sources and our income to the revenues that we have. And I think it's critical that you pull those numbers in. Your board members want to know how you're measuring up. And so if you're not doing critical benchmarking and reporting that, your donors are probably going to be asking you about it too. So they want to know how this organization measures up to similar organizations, certainly in the Kansas City area, but also nationally. And so I strongly encourage you to pull those sources. We have some of those on our website online, and I know that Nonprofit Connect, as well as the Community Foundation, has resources specific to the education subsector, or they can refer you to those to be able to see how you measure up in those areas. But it's very critical that you look at that, and I think you'll find some very reassuring statistics as well. So how we how our organizations responded to these changes, we held our salaries in. In this slide, I find the most interesting piece back to the age of alumni and the niche with the individual. You have reduced the cost of mailings. Not necessarily, we didn't hear that you've reduced the numbers as significantly, but you've reduced the cost of your mailings by over 60%. And you've increased internet contacts. And as I mentioned earlier, I've got four young alumni. And so I electronically communicated to all of them, and I said, so how many times are your universities connecting with you? And I got answers of some are connecting twice a week electronically with my kids, and some are connecting once a week, and some are connecting only every quarter. So there's real opportunity there. Whether it's creating a blog on a hot topic, getting your alumni circles together, getting your reunion club together to start a blog. I had an awesome conversation yesterday with, she certainly didn't look 79 to me, but a 79-year-old woman who said, as we ended our solicitation call, who said to me, do you have an email address? I'd love to keep in contact with you. My gosh, of course I'm going to give you my email address. I said, I love it that you're a techie. And she says, oh, you know, my husband just walks right past that computer on the desk. But I figured I've got to keep up with my kids. They are the age group we know that are, I don't have to tell, you're nodding. Of course you see that. They're the age group that's the fastest growing computer buyers. And class attendees, computer class attendees as well, those of you who offer computer classes to elders, we know that they're the fastest growing, and that's, again, you've got it on both ends of your alumni base. Young alumni thrive, and that's the way they want to be talked to. And then you've got this rapidly growing group of older alumni that want to be talked to that way as well. As I mentioned earlier, we've seen a significant number. I don't know that we have a funder other than Lori in the with the Community Foundation in the room to talk about the number of grant applications or the increase that they've seen over the past 8 months. But we've seen, these are the three areas that we've seen significant organizational changes in your approach to fundraising. And certainly, if you're not doing a planned giving program, you need to be considering it, because it's difficult, of course, to measure bequests in terms of what has to happen in order for that bequest to be measured. But those organizations that are changing their efforts are reaping benefits from it. So I don't have to tell you what are the best things to do, but just a quick reminder, certainly be creative and be strategic. If your staff want to be involved in the planning, engage them in a different way. Certainly be transparent with donors. And as I said earlier, be patient. They will want to give to you, but they may need to do it in a slightly different way. Maybe they need to do it with in-kind giving. Maybe they need to do it with a planned gift. So certainly be able to offer that to your donors. So some of the things that we might take away today include looking at clearly your closest constituents. Don't forget the parents. If you're a primary school or a high school, don't forget the parents once they've left you. Include them in an advisory capacity. Don't just ask them for money, but importantly, continue to communicate with them. Engage all of your donors in a more creative way. We talked about donor clubs and learning circles, and we've certainly had some wonderful opportunities that we've seen with those programs that focus on different age ranges and things that are specific to them, but focus as well on your volunteers. I heard our new chancellor from KU speak a couple weeks ago, and one of the points that she made that really stuck with me was she was talking, the room was filled with all ages, and she said, the first 10 years, we're not going to ask you for money. We want you to come back to the campus. Come back, join an activity, attend an event. We're going to communicate with you, and we want you back on campus. After 10 years, we're going to start asking you for money. So she thinks that's the window of engaging her alumni to become donors. Thank you all for being here. Now I'm going to turn it back to Barb.
Okay. All right, I hope your head is full of numbers that you're trying to process. We've given you a lot of excellent information, and I want to thank my colleagues. This is where we'd like to hear from you and in have you give us some feedback and information. And Jennifer, would you run this mic, please? Because we are doing a podcast, we need to have you speak into the microphone when you ask questions or provide information, so it'll take a minute to get it to you. So what's your initial reaction or your reflection about the information we've been sharing with you today? What comes up for you? Overwhelm? Yeah. Elaine?
I've been discounting the potential of individual donors. Concentrating on... Huh? Oh, I'm done.
Okay, so you discounting the concentration of individual donors and how important they are in fundraising.
The potential that was there. Individual donors, to me, seemed like a very small, and you know, the contacts that I have that are individuals don't have a lot of money. And so I had really discounted them.
Okay. And I think Lori gave a great example of how $5 from 10 people can make a huge difference, and letting people know that. You know, the more we hear about the good in an organization, what's going on, the more we want to participate and engage in it to be part of the success of the organization. Dale. Wait.
It's related to the individual donor issue, because if they're kind of a major pool out there, how do you identify them? It's a lot easier to identify a corporation or a foundation. You can kind of go searching for them. How do you can't really Google prospective donors at the individual level. It seems to me that's a kind of a several wave process, and I think I know how we've been trying to do it, but I'm not so sure how effective it's going to be, and I think this where some of us could be helped, locating the persons in that pool or locating techniques to get to persons in that pool to identify a set of prospective individual donors.
Okay. Any other initial reaction to the information? All right. How's your organization, and this may be a question people might be a little uncomfortable answering, but we'll see how we do here, is how are you dealing with the current fundraising climate? I mean, are you ecstatic? Are you optimistic? I talked with Celeste from Notre Dame, and she, in a conversation, mentioned that they are optimistic in their fundraising, that they've had two successful events this fall, and one driven by the students that raised more money than they had the year before with more donors. So that lends itself certainly to optimism. But what about the other folks here in the room? Jeffrey.
Well, Well, I was in Akron, Ohio yesterday with 25 YMCAs, probably with revenues of about $3 to $4 million or less in their YMCAs. And what they saw is over the last year that membership, which makes up about 80% of YMCA revenue, was down 10 to 15%. But over the last 3 to 4 months, they've seen revenue in memberships going up. So that's the earned income portion of their balance sheets or income statements, and that they're starting to see their annual appeal, which accounts for about 10 to 15% of all YMCA giving, increase as well starting this fall when many YMCAs across the country start doing their fundraising during their annual campaign during the last quarter and early part of the first quarter.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? What's going on with your Jan?
I think one of the things that we've been doing is doing smaller fundraisers than we had before. So we've done smaller things and a little more frequently.
And that's working for you?
Fairly well.
Okay. Great. Anyone else? What's going on?
You know, Mary Ellen talked about the funders forum, and I want to share that both in that group and in private conversations that we've had recently on feasibility studies, there are two things that the funders here in Kansas City are expecting. One is that you are going to be more modest. Most foundations don't give to special events, but they want to know what you're doing with respect to that so that you're creating more net income. The other one was a very direct comment from one member of the community saying that we're looking very hard at your annual budgets, and if you are budgeting giving that is increased or even just kind of a flat percentage projection of moving forward, we're going to be scrutinizing that and anticipating or assuming that you're not really taking a good hard look at what's going on. So if I could pass that on for your mutual benefit in terms of budgeting for next year and conversations that you're having with members of the funding community, you might want to be thinking about that.
And Lori, could I put you on the spot a minute? Have you seen an increase in the number of grant applications coming through the Community Foundation?
Most definitely. You know, the Community Foundation is really more about encouraging our donors. We focus a lot on donor education, and that's why I brought the program piece up, because that's a very important part of educating our donors on how to move from just being a funder but to being an investor. And so all that education is wrapped into looking at the total success of an organization as far as achieving their mission through their programs.
Christy, tell us what organization you're with, please.
Hello, I'm with the UMKC Foundation.
Okay.
One of my areas that I'm working in right now is the area of data mining and modeling, and I've been looking at national statistics, and I've also worked with Josh Burkholz and Peter Wiley. And one of the things that they're coming out with a white paper on that actually struck me as very interesting is that Peter Wiley studied several large and small education institutions across the nation and had found who are really your top donors and how can you identify them at a younger age or at an age when they're right out of school and cultivate a relationship. How do you pinpoint that person without feeling like you're just throwing darts at a board? One of the key things that Peter and Josh had came across that really struck me was that if an alum has attended at least 5 events within 5 years after graduation, they almost always become your largest donor of their class. And that was, to me, was very significant, and that made me really look at, number one, how are we tracking people who come to events? Who are we inviting? And are we tracking whether or not they actually attended? And just looking at people who are very consistent. And to me, that is You know, we talk about finding new people all the time, but sometimes Peter and Josh say they're right there in your database.
Yeah.
They're just hidden gems. It's just a matter of thinking of a creative way to go in there and to pull that data out and look at it in a different manner.
So if they attend ball games and alum meetings, things like that, where you'd find them? Or...
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay.
That's very interesting. Thank you for sharing.
We're working on a method to get the alumni officers to communicate with us with who attended, not only special events, but as volunteers and also as committee meetings. Because for them to come all the way down here and to attend a two-hour committee meeting is a big deal.
So. Okay. Paula.
I think that I was just going to say some of the things that we focused on, and some of it was before we saw this downturn, I think, in the economy, that we already recognized there was a need for this. We had a very loyal base of donors, and we weren't really acquiring new donors. And so what we've tried to do is work within our current supporters to try to introduce new people, so that trying to focus on the individuals, also really trying to tighten up those outcomes and really express what makes our program different. Really trying to articulate that to our donors. We've heard that from the foundations as well as a lot of our individual supporters. And then this year in particular, recognizing that need that we have for volunteers. We're kind of a medium-sized organization with a lot of staff support and resources to do what we provide in the community. However, there is a place for that and trying to work within that. And that's been tremendously helpful. I've seen not only in catalyzing the young professionals and a lot of legacy donors and volunteers, but also some new folks.
And I want to share an experience I had with De La Salle. I took a young man down there who I've known for many years, and he was thinking about going into education. And I thought this young man would be great in an urban school. And he called me this summer and said, "You'll be very proud of me. I'm enrolled in UMKC, and I'm going to get a teaching certificate." So that was a really meaningful experience with a young man for me, and how, you know, bringing together your institution and this person really created a great career opportunity for him. So he's 2 years before you get him. All right. What opportunities do you all see moving? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
This is more of an, I'll just say, this is more of an opinion question. Can you hear, is this on?
It's on.
Okay, I didn't. This is more of an opinion question for the Jeffrey Burton people, so whoever can answer this. You know, I'm looking at the sources of giving in Kansas City by subsector, and I saw this initially in the research and then again just when you presented it. And I'm wondering, given the year that we've had, with the foundation portion going to education, what do you feel will be the implications to educate the education sector, given the makeup, the large foundation makeup, and excuse me, and do you see a shift in that mix going forward?
I'm looking to Jeffrey, but that was actually a topic of conversation at the Funders Forum, not as it related to education, but generally about the foundation community. And Melissa Brown, who's the chief researcher for Giving USA, brought in some data from the Foundation Center. Maybe some of you read in the Chronicle on Philanthropy last March, April, about foundation giving. And she indicated that the last time that there was an economic climate like what we experienced last year, the tail on the foundation giving, where they started to feel the impact, was probably 13 to 18 months down the road. So these numbers artificially inflate foundation giving, but that it took 10 years for foundation giving to recover to the levels. So to me, that says it's good that you all get so much foundation giving, but just like every other sector that we're speaking with, you really need to be doing that work to uncover the alumni donor loyalty and start looking at individuals as an important source. Jeffrey?
Yeah, I would just echo what Jennifer said. From my understanding of the material on research on foundation giving after a recession, that foundations lag the other sources of income. Foundations in the third quarter of last year were having a good year asset-wise. And so they were on a roll to go ahead and give based on those assets. So we saw those assets decrease significantly over the last 12 months. I was with Bill Hall a number of months ago, and they had lost $200 million in assets at the Hall Family Foundation, which translated to $10 million in community support. And they're one of the two largest foundations that Jennifer mentioned, of 46% of giving out of that 75 of the top 10. So that I think what we'll see in 2010 probably here in Greater Kansas City is probably a decrease in foundation giving during 2010. And if the market rebounds with the way assets and some of the larger foundations are invested, that they're rolling over what, Lori, 36 months, like 12 quarters over 36 months on an average, we might see in 2011 giving coming back. I would be hesitant to say it's going to take us 10 years to get back into where we were a few years ago. I'm not sure if that's the case in Kansas City, since 18% of all giving comes from foundations. We are ahead, obviously, of the national average there, with 4% coming from the Community Foundation and 14% coming from other foundations. So I think it's a little bleak, perhaps, this next 4 or 5 quarters, and hopefully then that we'll see a rebound in 2011 as it relates to foundations.
I think it just points out that you need to keep in mind that foundation officers need to be cultivated just as much as your individual donors. So while they may not be able to give to you right now or only keeping their current giving steady, as one of Jeffrey's former volunteers used to say, go love them up. Okay, take the time now when you're not asking for money necessarily to build those relationships.
Okay. Mary Ellen has been taking notes, and we'll see that you receive a copy of this within a reasonable time frame. We're doing many workshops right now, so your patience would be appreciated. Any more comments or questions?
I wanted to pose a question. One of the things that we work on very hard at the Community Foundation is equipping our board members, because the entire responsibility of fundraising and helping us to generate revenue, we look to our board members. Ideally, they should be our best ambassadors out to the community. So I'm just kind of curious, is that something that you all work on very hard too? Giving circles are a great new it's relatively new phenomenon that provide people an opportunity to connect with friends and family members. It's a very casual type of giving setup. So people don't feel as uncomfortable maybe as if it's in a formal more type of setting. And so giving circles, you know, that are set up for your organizations, or casual giving circles that your donors or your board members create within their own circles of friends and family, are other ways that you can kind of look for innovative ways to drive the fundraising as well.
This month when you have the session with board members?
The Boards of Tomorrow training, yeah. The Boards of Tomorrow training that Nonprofit Connect does, yes. We do a two-day, two-hour training for people that are either interested in serving on boards or new board members. The focus, it's a program that we inherited from the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation several years ago. And the focus of that is we talk about fiscal responsibility. Well, I should say we start off with kind of Nonprofits 101. And then we talk about fiscal responsibility, governance responsibility, the roles and responsibilities in the relationship between staff and board. And then we talk about fundraising responsibility also, and they get a book that also talks about that for them. So it's a great way for someone else to deliver the message that maybe it's not so easy for you to deliver. So if you have more questions about that training, just let me know.
All right. It's 9:30, and we have a practice of ending on time. I want to thank you for being here, for your questions, your participations. Please feel free at any time to contact any of us, Michelle.
Absolutely.
Lori, Jeffrey, Jennifer, Barbara, Mary Ellen, Terry. We will be happy to answer your questions and hope you will tell other folks in other sectors about these workshops, encourage them to come. And we look forward to seeing you sometime soon. Thank you.
And I wanted to add one last thing. You saw when you came in, if you didn't receive it in the mail, the flyer for the Philanthropy Midwest Conference in November. And one of the things you talked about today was really attracting, how do you reach out and network with those younger donors? And there is a whole lot of sessions this fall about social networking, how to make strategic decisions about what's right for your organization, and then also on the implementation level, there are workshops as well. So I think that would be something you might want to check out. We do have some scholarships still available for the conference. The deadline is to apply is tomorrow. So if you're interested, please let me know, and I'll make sure that you get that paperwork to apply. So thanks again for coming today. Yeah.
I'm never asked to spell on the table.
Washing machines, they're on the side.